This is the Seahawkers Podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and we're closing out day three of our bonus Seahawks NFL draft coverage. Joining me all the way from England, fighting through some late nights over there, is Rob Staton of SeahawksDraftBlog.com. Rob, we got through it. The Seahawks made some maneuvers throughout the draft and ended up making at least one pick in every single round of the draft.
Yeah, we're here at the end, and I think you have to judge this draft independently of where they are in the context of the season, because I think a lot of people will do is they will just look at the eight names that are down in the list of the 2020 draft class, and they will say, well, they haven't done this, and they haven't done that, and they haven't done the other, and there are definitely still holes on this roster that are going to need to be addressed. But because they were relatively inactive in free agency, they were never going to come out of this draft class with everything sorted. You know, it was just unrealistic. You know, I don't think there's any team that can go into a draft with as many needs as the Seahawks have and with the picks that they had and then come out of it feeling like, yeah, everything's sorted. If you've got three first-round picks like the Dolphins, then yeah, sure, you know, that's a lot easier to do. But the Seahawks didn't. You know, they had one first-round pick, a couple of second-round picks, a late third, and they had to make do with what they have. So I think overall, it's not a bad draft class by any stretch. I can definitely see some major upside in some of the players they've got. You know, right through from pick one to all the way through to pick eight, there are players in this class who could eventually develop into productive starters or role players for this roster. You know, there's no picks among the list that you kind of think, well, that's a throwaway pick. You know, when they drafted like Jimmy Statton back in the day, you kind of thought, well, where does he fit in? Where's he come from? I've never heard of him before.
Right.
And that, it just looked like there's a guy who's going to be cut before the end of training camp. Whereas I look at this list and there is legitimately a plausible reason to think all of these players are going to make it. So I think from that point of view, it's good. But you know, the problem the Seahawks have got is that they came into this offseason with all this stuff to do. And because they weren't aggressive and particularly proactive in free agency, you know, they've added depth players and a lot of journeymen. They haven't added high impact starter players. You know, Russell Wilson called for superstars. They've not gone and done that. They've left themselves in this position now where after the draft, as last year, they've got to go out and hit the veteran market again and try and find some answers.
And I think my one critique from the draft just overall, just when I was thinking about the needs for the team going into this, pass rush was definitely a need, and they addressed that. They picked up two pass rushers in the draft. We talked about Daryl Taylor out of Tennessee on day two. And then they get Alton Robinson here on day three. And I want to go through all the day three picks, but just to get to the critique, the only thing that I felt like I would have liked to see them get is a tackle out of this draft. And they had the opportunity to do that in round one. They go with Jordan Brooks. Jordan Brooks may end up being an amazing player and that I won't have anything to complain about, but it just that was my one area of need that I felt like going into this that they had an opportunity to address, and they get through the draft and they don't take any tackles.
Again, I think it's really about the situation that they'd put themselves in. I mean, they had this huge issue at the end of last season, you know, and that Green Bay game finished. We were talking about it from then right up until the week leading up to free agency. They can't defend the perimeter run. Their tackling is poor. Their pass rush is not good enough. They're not tough enough on defense. They're getting linebackers being blocked by Aaron Rodgers. You know, that was the sentiments that we were saying after that game. And when free agency started, my expectation was they are going to massively improve the front seven of the defense. We're going to see a couple of pass rushers signed. We may see a defensive tackle sign. You know, we're going through some of the names that they could go and target there, and a real concerted effort in free agency to solve some of their problems. And everything seemed to be moving in that direction. They were speaking quite confidently and positively at the combine. You've got Russell Wilson making the statement that he did at the Pro Bowl about superstars. It just felt like everything was, you know, even Pete Carroll saying, I'm going to the Pro Bowl to recruit, felt like, look, they're leaving no stone unturned. Even Carroll's going to coach at the Pro Bowl this year. So they're doing everything they can to try and take the next step. And then when free agency started and their main moves were low-level offensive line additions and, a couple of journeyman pass rushers, you were sort of left scratching your head thinking, well, where's the direction here? And as a consequence of that, when they go into this draft, they've had to focus on that. Their two first picks were on the defensive front seven. Now, if they'd have fixed that in free agency, then you look at this and you say, okay, we've got our additions there. What can we do here? A tackle like Isaiah Wilson, for example, probably would have been a lot more likely than it otherwise was. You know, some of the other tackles that we expected to go in that range, Ezra Cleveland, for example, lasted deep into round two. Clearly the league was not as high on him as maybe the media was making out. And Josh Jones lasted all the way to round three. So actually the legitimate, realistic tackle options at the end of round one were not really there as soon as Austin Jackson left the board at number 18. It was really just about Isaiah Wilson. And if you want to consider Robert Hunt a tackle rather than a guard, they were the two options. So I can see why they didn't do that. It's a shame they weren't able to add someone with some developmental potential in day three. Someone like Sadiq Charles at LSU would have been a good player to come in and try and work into a starting role in a couple of years' time. But yes, you know, if Dwayne Brown doesn't play beyond 2020, or if he gives it up after 2021, in a year or two, the Seahawks are going to have to try and find a left tackle option, and they found that particularly hard, not drafting in the top 10.
Well, and you know, to be fair to my own critique, the Seahawks haven't been all that great at drafting tackles over the years anyway. So I guess if they were to take a tackle at the end of round one and whiff, I guess I'd be pretty upset about that too.
You see, timing's everything, isn't it? You know, the San Francisco 49ers have started the day, and their fans were, you know, they had a couple of first round picks and then nothing for ages. And, you know, they've not had many picks at all in this draft. And, you know, I guess that 49ers fans would have woken up today probably not that excited about the draft. They'd done most of their work already. They'd done most of the things they needed to do. And then you find out that your, you know, long-term starter at left tackle, Joe Staley, is retiring. And before that announcement's even been made, you've traded for Trent Williams, one of the best left tackles in the league.
Right.
You know, you compare that to the toil and the struggle that the Seahawks had once Russell Okung had left. You know, I can't even remember the guy's name who played left. Was it Bradley Sowell?
You know, like he played, did for a little bit, yeah, yeah.
You know, they had George Fant playing there as a basketball player, undrafted free agent. They, you know, they had to go out and Reese Odhiambo played there. They had to go and be very aggressive to go and trade for Dwayne Brown. That cost them a second and a third round pick, whereas the 49ers have now got Trent Williams for a fifth round pick this year and a third round pick next year. So, you know, even the deal's better from San Francisco's point of view. Now, granted, Williams hasn't been playing. You know, it'll be 2 years before he's played a game of football by the time he eventually takes the field. Who knows what kind of shape he's in. Physically also, there were some concerns, weren't there, that his health had deteriorated in Washington. So we have to wait and see. But you see moves like that, and that's the sort of the takeaway that I come from this offseason. I fully expected the Seahawks to be the team that were the aggressor in the AFC West, to try and catch up with the Niners, to try and get on top again, to try and win that division. And what we've actually seen is the 49ers replacing, they've lost some guys, but they've replaced them with two first-round picks and Trent Williams. And Arizona have brought in Nuke Hopkins to play wide receiver, and they've drafted Isaiah Simmons. And for those two teams, you think, wow, you know, that is a really good offseason. From the Seahawks' point of view, we can say they've added depth, they've added a bit more toughness and some physicality to the offense. But have they really brought anybody in who's going to push the needle? Is anybody out there that they've added so far going to be the difference between this team being a wild card and a divisional playoff round team again and actually making the Super Bowl? And I have to say, unfortunately, I don't think any of the additions have.
No, it does seem like a lot of depth type pieces and you know, your chance to add impact players are really on day one, day two of the draft. Day three, you're looking at guys who can fill out your roster, potentially come in and be that guy who they did pretty well early on back in the 2011, 2012 season to bring in guys like Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor, who are late round guys that have gone on to make a big impact. But that's very unusual.
Can I just make one quick final part? You know, the other thing I want to qualify on this is nobody ever really knows how an NFL season is going to go. I mean, who would have thought that this time last year, the San Francisco 49ers had just picked second overall, and then they ended up in the Super Bowl. So me sitting here saying they've not drafted or signed anybody to push them towards the Super Bowl, that's fair enough for me to say that in the end of April, but it doesn't mean that I'm right. And when the season actually begins, who knows what's going to happen? You know, usually it's the team that's the healthiest that gets through and ends up contending at the end. And the team that is the most physical does that. And the Seahawks have signed some tough guys. They have improved their depth. Maybe they have given themselves a better chance to get to the Super Bowl next year, but it would have been really good to see them actually fix the pass rush this offseason. They could still do that, but they've got to get on with it now. And they've got to go and try and find a defensive tackle. They've got to try and get Clowney done, or Griffin, or both. And they've got to make some moves there in order to really push them in towards contention.
You never know. There may be some guys here. There are some guys with some tremendous upside, I think. But let's go down the list, Rob, of the day three picks for the Seahawks, starting with your thoughts on Colby Parkinson, the tight end out of Stanford.
Colby Parkinson, people might not remember this, but at the start of the college football season, he was being quite highly regarded as a potential first-round pick. He was seen as the best tight end in college football, or the tight end with the most potential to go on and make it into the first round. And it never really happened for him. He was probably caught up a little bit in the fact that Stanford were really bad in 2019 and seemed to be regressing as a team. But then the usage of him, he hasn't been used in the way that Stanford tight ends get used. You think of, you know, the Zach Ertzes and the Kobe Fleeners and guys like that. Yeah, they were good pass catchers, but they also were asked to do an awful lot of blocking. And when I watched Parkinson, I kind of turned the tape off quite quickly because I thought, he's not doing any blocking. They're splitting him out wide as a receiver. He's being used not even as a move tight end. He's actually just being used as a wide receiver who happens to be 6'7" and 250 pounds. And, you know, that's not really what the Seahawks have gone for in the past. But then from his testing point of view, and we've talked about it before, Brandon, you know, that 7.103 cone is sort of the target. And when you've got guys like Hunter Henry and Rob Gronkowski and all of the guys that Seattle have drafted at the position running in that range, he runs a 7.15. He's big, he's tall, he's long, and then he runs that three cone. I can definitely see why the Seahawks have seen some potential there. And I wouldn't be surprised if they thought, this is a guy who was being graded in the first round a year ago. He's not lived up to his potential, or Stanford have not enabled him to live up to his potential in 2019. But we can get a steal here in the fourth round. We see him as maybe a second or third round graded player, and we've got him in round four.
And he is a guy coming out of Stanford who didn't drop any passes. He has that low drop rate. So a guy that, with the big catch radius of a guy who's 6'7", I could see him being a potential target for Russell Wilson. Between the two guys at tight end, Luke Wilson and Jacob Hollister on the roster, they aren't going to carry five tight ends going into the season. So do you think, which one of those guys do you think he has the most likelihood to replace?
I mean, possibly Luke Wilson. I don't know. I mean, I think they can leave that situation right up until the last minute when they have to make a call. You know, if there is a camp and a preseason, and let's fingers crossed that there is, then they can let the competition go out there. I mean, what I'd really like to see, Brandon, is I am a little bit jealous sort of watching the way that the Niners and the Rams use their tight ends. You know, when you watch San Francisco play the Seahawks, the way that they manufacture their routes to get George Kittle open and play to his skill set, and then you watch him just find, he's just open all of the time. You know, it's just ridiculous. You know, in fact, there was that final game of the season, there were a couple of times when he was wide open. For some reason, Jimmy Garoppolo didn't look his way. And that could have been a much easier victory for the Niners than it ended up being in the end. And with the Rams, I mean, they just destroyed the Seahawks with their, like, crossing routes and the tight end getting in space and stuff like that. And I'd like to see the Seahawks try and do a bit of that. It's one of the best ways to win, or one of the easiest ways to win, is to get a tight end and get him in space and do all of those things. And when Disley got injured last year, the Seahawks really lost their ability to do those. So with Greg Olsen now, and hopefully Disley coming back, and with Parkinson and Hollister and Luke, you know, they've got a bunch of guys there that they can do these things with. And I'd like to see them be a little bit more creative with a tight end in the offense moving forward.
Looking at Pro Football Focus, they have Parkinson graded as the top receiving tight end in that 10 to 19 yard range, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and you know, he's reasonably fast. You know, he's agile. He's got a good, tall, long frame, and I think he could be a threat. You know, I just hope that they use him in very creative ways. It's one thing, you know, I've just got this image that what they will try and do is try and turn him into a complete tight end, and not everybody's going to be able to do that. You know, they did that with Jimmy Graham. They spent 3 years with Jimmy Graham doing that, and then just gave in and made him a red zone threat, and he ended up getting like 10, 15 touchdowns in his final season. Sometimes you're just going to say, this is what the weapon is. He is going to be a dynamic red zone threat, but get him moving on some crossing routes, get him in space, try and create the routes that are going to get him open and make life easy for Russell Wilson so that he's got a check down. And these are the kind of things that, like I say, the Seahawks don't do very well. The Green Bay game is a very good example of that in the playoff game, because we all were, you know, I'd written about it. You know, it's not because I've got any great insight on this. It was simply because you knew that's what was going to happen. The running game had collapsed. No one was respecting the running game because all of the running backs were injured. So we knew that Green Bay was going to sit in coverage and they were going to dare the Seahawks to run the ball because we'll handle it up front. And that's exactly what happened. It took Wilson, like, I don't know, a whole half of the game and maybe a bit longer to actually find the ways that he could attack Green Bay because they were just sitting in blanket coverage and playing everything deep and saying, we're not going to let DK Metcalf beat us. But if you've actually got a tight end that can exploit, when you're doing that, you're sitting deep and you've got a tight end, you've got two tight ends who can run crosses and get into those seams and find the soft spots in zone. When you've got someone who can do that, it's a way to combat those things when you are struggling a little bit. And some teams are going to be able to handle Seattle's running game. You've got to throw those counter punches. And that's why Seattle has slow starts sometimes, because they spend all this time working out the way that they're going to attack opponents. If they've got multiple ways to attack opponents anyway, and they can just kind of spend a drive finding that out, or a couple of drives rather than a whole half, then they can start faster and they can get at teams a little bit more. And that's something they've got to do next year.
Well, you mentioned running back depth being an issue, and they addressed that as well in round four, drafting DJ Dallas, running back out of Miami. And it was kind of interesting, Rob, because, you know, we talked about the different types of we talked about really the single type of running back that the Seahawks tend to look for in terms of, you know, the height and weight and speed and that sort of thing. And there were quite a few guys that fit that profile going into this draft. But once you got toward the end of round four, there weren't a whole lot of those guys that fit those particular measurements that the Seahawks look for left.
No, and Dallas was one of the few that were left on the list. And it's not a real surprise that they took him in round four. He fits all of their physical ideals. He's not as explosive as some of the other running backs, but he was on the list. He fit their explosive traits. He's such a tough runner, you know, very physical. He's exactly the type of player you'd expect them to go and draft. And in round four, you know, if he could be Robert Turbin for them, you know, a solid backup running back who comes in and takes some snaps some of the time, then it's decent value. They had to add someone. It is disappointing, you know, that they did not get a real chance to get one of the top five, because I thought there was five really good running backs, you know. And by that, you know, DJ Dallas is somebody who could be, like I say, a Robert Turbin type. The top five in this class all have got the potential to be top five running backs statistically in the league, you know, and to really lead a dynamic running attack and be at the top of the charts for running statistics. You know, Jonathan Taylor at Indianapolis will probably have an absolutely brilliant first season. Clyde Edwards-Helaire could be practically unstoppable with all the other weapons around him in Kansas City. J.K. Dobbins and Cam Akers and DeAndre Swift have all got a chance to be really, really, really good. And to not have the ability to go and get one of those for a team that wants to run so much was a little bit hard to take. And also, the good thing about getting one of those five would have been that there'd been no real pressure to extend Chris Carson's contract at the end of the upcoming season. They would have had options there. If they wanted to extend him, they could have done. If they wanted to move on, they could have done. By not getting one of those guys now, they are really dependent on him coming back and Penny coming back and them staying healthy. Because as much as I like DJ Dallas, and I think it's a decent fourth round pick, you don't really want him and Travis Homer and Marshawn Lynch trying to get you to the Super Bowl again. I know that some people think running backs don't matter, but they did at the end of last season.
Well, as we're talking here, Rob, I'm watching Twitter and seeing some of the undrafted free agent signings come in. And they did pick up another running back from FIU, Anthony Jones.
Well, they need some depth there. They need depth and they need competition, you know. And I think they'll probably go and sign a veteran, whether it is Isaiah Crowell, who was linked with them, whether it's Marshawn Lynch again. I think the Lynch one's probably more likely to happen towards the end of training camp, so that Marshawn doesn't have to do anything.
Right.
But they've got some options there. But like I said, I think the Seahawks want to run the ball. Okay, and the conversation isn't about whether that's the right thing or not. It's about how are they going to best put their plan in action. And I do worry a little bit that, you know, with Carson's injury history and he's recovering from a hip injury and Penny's now got this serious knee injury, you know, the offense could really struggle because they haven't really got the depth there. And, you know, Crowell and Marshawn, you know, they're decent backups, but you know, they haven't really got a great deal of dynamism in these backup spots. They haven't got anybody like, and then they're not really shown they can just recycle and, you know, different players and put them in from other teams like the 49ers have under the Shanahan scheme. It feels like they actually need a type of runner and they need a bit of quality there as well. So like I said, it's quite disappointing they didn't manage to find a way to get one of the top five, but they've got to move on. You know, Leonard Fournette's still out there. I don't know whether they're interested in him or not, or whether he's even likely to be traded now. I mean, he may even be cut because they've not done anything here. I don't know what the prospect is of that. But they could do with keep out. I mean, they've pumped up so many positions, like O-line and tight end. They've got so many of those, they could probably start a union. With the running backs, they haven't done that. They didn't sign any before the draft. They've spent a fourth-round pick on DJ Dallas. I quite like to see them go out and try and get a couple of veteran running backs to add some depth and some competition to that position.
Yeah, Fournette might be a guy to watch, because as you get into day three of the draft and you start looking at the running backs, I think you say to yourself, too, Fournette could be the better option of any of the guys that they could potentially draft that were left on the board for the class. So let's move on to round five and the Seahawks. They had the second pick in round five, and they take Alton Robinson, the defensive end out of Syracuse.
Yeah, I mean, he's somebody who, you know, people talk about him in very positive terms. And yet, whenever I watched him on tape, I always kind of was left really underwhelmed. You know, he doesn't create a lot of pressure. His pass rush win percentage is about 15.9%, which is decent, but it's not great. You know, it's a good 3% lower than Darrell Taylor's, for example. He just didn't look particularly good, you know. And I think you see little flashes there, but it is very, very few flashes.
Right.
And you think, well, you know, where's that? Because he's explosive. He ran the second best short shuttle, a 4.32 at the combine this year. So he's definitely got the kind of traits that you look for in an edge rusher, but he just hasn't been able to put it together into sort of like consistent production. He has got short arms, and I don't know whether that plays an impact there. I thought at the Senior Bowl, again, I was always left wanting more when I was watching the 1v1s. He didn't jump off the screen in the way that other players did. But he has some traits. He's been working out, surprisingly, given that he went to Syracuse. And I think he's originally from Texas, I think. He was working out in Bellevue for some reason with Cliff Averill and some of the other Seahawks players. He's met Bobby Wagner, I think I read, which is kind of strange. But maybe it gives the Seahawks a little bit of insight into who he is. If he's been spending some time with them, I'm sure they would have given the players a call to get their thoughts. And look, it's a fifth-round pick. You know, it's a flyer. It's the kind of range where if this doesn't work out, then so what? If it does work out, then you end up with a real value pick. And, you know, they needed to bring some competition at defensive end as well. And, you know, if Alton Robinson, I mean, the challenge for Alton Robinson now is to beat out someone like Brandon Jackson. Make sure that Brandon Jackson is not on the roster this year and upgrade that position as a consequence. That is the challenge for him.
And to me, Robinson, he seems more like the guy who is more suited in the run game than the pass game. You look at his run stops, he's up there, up above Darrell Taylor, and grades out better in the run game as well. So it's almost as though they address the edge position as, you know, if it worked out to where Alton Robinson was the first and second down guy, and then Darrell Taylor's more of the third round guy, you put those together, and maybe you have your complete three down pass rusher.
The problem he's going to have, though, is that, you know, this is why long arms matter, because you need to keep your frame clean. You need to keep those guys off. And, you know, if NFL offensive tackles, there might not be many good ones in the league, but most of them will be able to get into these edge rushers and, you know, get into their frames and get into their chest. And he has to be able to sort of extend. Now, whether he's going to one arm everybody and try and go for that, or whether he's going to have to try and use his quickness and his agility to get to the edge, I don't know. But, I mean, he is... is an athletic specimen. I mean, to look at him, he actually looks like he could probably tone up a little bit. You know, he's carrying a bit of extra weight. He could maybe even get physically in a better shape and become even more powerful and strong. But he ran a good 40. He ran a good three short shuttle. And in terms of explosive testing, he did a 3.41 in TEF, which was the same mark as Marcus Davenport, who the Saints traded two first-round picks for a few years ago.
Right.
So that goes to show the kind of athletic potential he's got. He now just has to put it all together. He's going to take some developing, and, you know, Darrell Taylor's the same. I'd be surprised if either of them had an instant impact on the Seahawks roster, but they've got potential and upside.
In round six, the Seahawks go to receiver. The first time they take a receiver off the board, obviously going pass catcher with Parkinson early on. But Freddie Swain, a 4.4 runner out of Florida. And receiver was a position that we talked about them maybe potentially addressing early on. I know there's a lot of depth here and maybe not the need with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett on the roster, and with them going and signing a free agent receiver as well. So they get Freddie Swain here and potentially somebody who can take over the punt return, kick return type role.
Yeah, and I think that's the main thing with him. He's good at that, and also as a receiver, he's fast enough. You know, he's in the 4.4s. We know they love 4.4 runners. When he plays in the slot, he can definitely find ways to get open with his quickness. There's evidence of him getting downfield. I think his route running needs to improve. He doesn't run particularly crisp routes. That's something that he's going to have to really work on.
Right.
But on the first day of training camp, they can put him back there and say, right, punt returns, kick returns, go and win yourself a job. And if he can beat out some of the other guys, and look, DJ Dallas might be in that competition as well. There's a few guys who are going to be on the roster who need to be able to show they can wear more than one hat. And that's Freddie Swain's pathway to the roster. It is to show that he can do kick returns, because they definitely need somebody to do that. They can't keep relying on Tyler Lockett doing these dual roles. They need to protect Tyler Lockett to keep him going for a few more years yet. And that means someone like Freddie Swain winning that job. Hopefully he can do that.
And finally, the Seahawks trade a future sixth round pick to get up into the seventh to select a guy who's listed as tight end, but ultimately a guy that the Seahawks say that they have him pegged as a wide receiver. And that's Steven Sullivan, the tight end out of LSU. Interesting thing, looking at Pro Football Focus's draft guide, they had Sullivan listed as the fifth tight end among their tight ends. Although, if you look at his profile, they spent a lot of his draft profile saying how he wasn't that great of a tight end.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing with Sullivan is, athleticism-wise, he's a real mixed bag. So, incredible 40 time of, you know, for a guy his size, you know, in the 4.6s at a tight end who is 6'5". He's got incredible length. He's got 35.5-inch arms. He's very explosive, 36.5-inch vertical. But his agility testing was dreadful, and that's why he's still here in round 7. You know, his 3-cone and short shuttle were really, really bad. Now, the Seahawks are listing him as a wide receiver, which is interesting. Now, he's going to flick between receiver and tight end, but the Seahawks are listing him as a receiver. High character guy, was very well respected at LSU. Everybody knows the story about him and the hardship that he had to deal with to get to this point in his career. I can just imagine Ed Orgeron saying, "Hey, Pete, you're going to draft this guy, man." You know, and giving him a call, and then Pete saying, "John, we've got to get this done. We've got to get back into the seventh round because Ed's rung me and told me what a great guy this is." So, I'm completely comfortable with the move. I like it when the Seahawks show a bit of conviction, Brandon. I don't know what you feel about that. You know, when I see that the Seahawks have traded up, because there's so much trading down and trying to work the board into their favor and get as many guys as possible, when I actually see them make a move to go and get somebody, those moves generally tend to work. So I quite like this move here. It's a shot to nothing. Can he come in and compete at receiver and see if he can provide a bit of a spark? And this is the thing I like about the class. You know, as I mentioned at the start, from the first pick to the eighth pick, all of these guys have either got proven production and quality, or they've got mass potential, or they've got both. And that's a good thing.
Well, when you're talking about giving up a future sixth or future seventh round pick, that doesn't bother me at all, because they could very well get to training camp and realize, hey, we have a few extra players on the roster who aren't going to make the 90-man, and on cut down day, that's when you start to see guys traded for those sixth and seventh round picks. So I look at those picks as just future pieces for movement. And even during the season, I mean, John Schneider's done such a great job of moving around future fifth, sixth, and seventh picks. If they're using a future sixth to trade up for a guy that they think has a chance to compete, it's just a little bit curious to me with Sullivan and Parkinson almost feeling like they have very similar type of roles in college, as being more of the split out wide tight end, very similar height. Parkinson obviously a little bit taller, but Sullivan has the longer arms. And so it almost seemed like they have two guys competing for the same spot just within the same draft. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that that's what it seemed like at first to me. And then they said, oh, no, Sullivan's a wide receiver.
Yeah, possibly so. I think overall it's a decent looking group of players. And I've seen a few people on Twitter. I've not really seen... I keep hearing that people are reacting in certain ways on Twitter. I obviously don't follow the right people, because I've not really seen that much angst, actually. From what I've seen, it's been quite a milquetoast reaction to everything the Seahawks are doing. It just sort of comments on the players and people sort of weighing it up in quite a balanced way, most on Twitter-like. when people were sort of saying, one thing I did see was people were comparing it to the Baltimore draft. And that's, you know, understandable because the Seahawks picked right before Baltimore and people are going to say Jordan Brooks and Patrick Queen. And then you look at what the Ravens have done. I think people need to remember here that this, I actually had a look at this. The Seahawks couldn't have had most of the players. The Ravens might have picked right behind the Seahawks in the first round, but it wasn't like that happened throughout the rest of the draft. The Ravens had picks in certain areas that the Seahawks were not drafting in, and they had more picks than Seattle. So they were able to go and get certain players in certain ranges that Seattle just had no chance of at all. And, yeah, you know, Patrick Queen has his question marks. He's more of a well-known player than Jordan Brooks, and he's more... You know, it's just because he's at LSU, he's a guy that you, sort of your name recognition is straight away there.
Right.
And he has flaws. You know, where was he before this year? You know, why was he a non-factor? Why did nobody know who Patrick Queen was until the 2019 season? Justin Madubuike, he's undersized and didn't have great production, but, you know, there was some good things with him as well. As we talked about, great one-gapper, very stout against the run. It emerged in the last week that there were some character concerns. So that's why he went in the third round instead of the second. Malik Harrison is a middle linebacker thumper. You know, he couldn't play in space. Devin Duvernay is all right. You know, he's not a bad player, but I think he received more receiver screens in college football than any other player last year. You know, he's that sort of short area player. You get the ball in his hands and he does make stuff happen. Is he going to be able to do that at the next level? I'm not sure. So, yeah, I don't think it's healthy to look at other teams and say, well, could they have done that? Could they have done this? I think when you actually look at Seattle's class, it's a decent group of players. The problem is that they've just got so much still left to do, as I said. And yeah, actually, what do you think they're going to do, Brandon? I mean, it's all, you know, I've got my opinion. What are they going to do? Because they've got a decision to make on Justin Britt. Do they save money there and play BJ Finney and try and use some of that money to go and sign some of the remaining free agents who are out there, because there are running backs and defensive ends and defensive tackles who are out there, receivers as well. Do they go and make some kind of a big trade? What do you think they're going
to
do?
Well, it does feel to me that they've set themselves up for some flexibility with the different positions that they brought on. If they decide to move on from KJ Wright and save some cap money there, if they decide to move on from Justin Britt, save some cap money there, if they, you know, even... in the margins with a guy like DJ Fluker. They have so many guards now. If they needed to make just a little bit of room at right guard with having Damian Lewis on the roster now and then having Chance Wormack signed, that's a spot where I could see them saying, okay, Fluker, we're going to take the chance here and make a guy like Lewis and Wormack compete for that right guard spot. Jordan Simmons, a guy coming back too that we saw play one game as a starter at right guard too. So they have so much depth at some of these positions that it gives them that flexibility. So if when you get to training camp and there's guys getting cut that are pass rushers too, and they still haven't addressed that need, I think that that's what they're set up for right now.
I mean, I think the big question is Britt. You know, what are they going to do with him? Because I think there's a date coming up whereby if they cut him after a certain date, he gets life insurance or something. Hmm. Or health insurance from the NFL. It's some kind of weird deal there that I don't know the minutiae of the detail in, but he will get some support from the league if they wait beyond a certain day. So are they going to cut him after that? Are they going to say to him, look, we're going to cut you if you're not willing to rework your contract and lessen the hit? Would Justin Britt rather just have the security of a long-term extension on a lower cap number this year, or is he actually going to want to go and test the market? I don't think he'd be really... I mean, if you're Justin Britt, do you really want to be on the open market right after the draft when everybody's done all their work and you're recovering from an ACL injury? It might be, you know, within his interests to work with the team a little bit here. And I don't think he'd get a massive contract. So, you know, it's not like he's going to reach the market and there's going to be teams clamoring over each other to get Justin Britt. So it might be within his interest to work his contract to the Seahawks to create some cap room there. I don't think they're going to cut KJ Wright at all. I think they've talked, you know, even when they signed just Jordan Brooks, they were going KJ this, KJ that, KJ, you know, we're going to use all three, we're going to do all this. I think, Wright is probably going to be on the roster this year and then maybe he will retire after this season. Fluker, I think they're so intent on having this mass competition at guard. I think if Fluker leaves, it'll probably be, you know, on cut down day rather than any time before that. Britt's the one. And then, you know, can they go out and who are they going to sign? You know, is it a Snacks Harrison? Is it someone as big a name as that? Or is it a Mebane, you know, the old school veteran type that they bring back in here? Running backs they've got to do. You know, there are some other players at other positions who are still available as well. And, you know, I wonder if they might actually go out and get another receiver because they didn't draft one, which is a bit of a surprise. And it's great receiver class, certainly Stephen Sullivan, who they're calling a receiver, and Freddie Swain at the end. You know, in those first sort of 3-4 rounds when the meat of the position was available, they didn't draft anybody, so they might go and look at that position and get a veteran and get a bit more depth there. But the key to everything is Clowney and Everson Griffin, isn't it? It's being able to get at least one of those two done. And I just wonder what happens now. Are they going to see this all the way through to whenever training camp is, or whenever the coronavirus is enabling the people to travel again so they can go and do medicals, just to wait out Clowney to the very last minute? Or are they going to say, come on, now's the time to get this sorted? Is Clowney going to sign for somebody else once the comp pick thing kicks into gear in the next few days?
Yeah,
you know, what's going to happen there? I'm almost at the point now, Brandon, where I kind of hope he does sign somewhere else so they can just get a move on signing.
We just need to know.
We just need some closure on this.
Right.
This is the final point. The thing is that they've got to be careful here. Because, yeah, they've got Darrell Taylor and they've got Mayo and they've got Irvin, and they can talk themselves into 15 sacks last year as much as they want. It was 7.5 between them the year before. They ended up in this situation last year and they were bailed out by Houston, giving them Jadeveon Clowney. The guy that they signed this time last year was Ziggy Ansah, and he was awful. So they've got to be careful here. They can't be going into next season thinking they've got enough at pass rush, because they haven't. And they can't rest on the laurels of this. They can't rely on, we'll be okay, we'll be okay, we're a good team. They're a good team because of the quarterback. They've got to give the support to that quarterback now. They've got to go and address this properly. They've got to get this sorted. They've got to get some proper pass rushers who can create pressures and create sacks and hurt teams and hurt opponents and make teams not want to play the Seahawks, because they haven't got that at the moment.
I do think, though, just listening to John Schneider in his press conferences, that he's aware that there is still an issue there, and he had wanted to be more aggressive in the offseason. I think he's content with being patient in some regards, because they were patient enough to get Clowney, and, you know, with Ngakoue being out there on the market and other teams, you know, potentially once the draft ends and once they get to training camp, they may shed some of their veteran talent too. So there may be options for that. And to where you look at toward the start of the season, that patience may have paid off, especially with Clowney, because we were talking about him being a $20 million plus guy going into free agency. If he ends up signing, I mean, anywhere under $15 million, I think, before the start of the season, you start looking at that as a potential bargain, and then they have additional space to work with there. I'm curious to see how the rest of this offseason goes, how they put those pieces together. We're starting to see some of the undrafted free agents come in too. There's some interesting names here, Rob, I figure I'll throw out to you. But I do think they are going to look at this and understand that, yes, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah,
going in the months leading up to the season.
The problem with patience, right? Patience is great. If it all works out in the end and you get what you need to do, you get that all done, then that's great. Then you look like the smartest guy in the room and everything's good. But sometimes you can wait too long and you can be too cute on these things. And the last thing the Seahawks are not really in a position where if they wait this out, and then Clowney signs somewhere else and Griffin signs somewhere else, and they genuinely are banking on Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayowa and hopefully Darrell Taylor and Elton Robinson and LJ Collier and the rest to actually provide them with a proper pass rush. If they're going to try and do that, then they're going to end up wasting another season. And then we'll all be sat here and talk about the same subject again in a year's time. And Russell Wilson will be a year older, and they'll be a year further away from the last time they were a proper contender. You know, they've got to go and get this thing sorted. There's going to come a point when patience isn't, that time's going to have gone. But sometimes you've got to be proactive and you've just got to go out there and solve a problem. And if that means you have to pay a little bit more sometimes, then you have to pay a little bit more. You've got to go and get this done. You've got to come to some common ground with either Everson Griffin or Jadeveon Clowney, or even both, or whatever. Whatever you're going to do, you need to go and get this sorted now so that the Seahawks can start the 2020 season. And look, they've done this before. They have been very proactive in the past. They started the 2017 season having just traded for Sheldon Richardson for a second-round pick. They were very aggressive there. You know, they have been very, very, very aggressive. I mean, that season, that's when they traded for Dwayne Brown as well, when they've been proactive to try and get stuff done in the past. And they kind of go from extremes. They're either too aggressive or too passive. You know, there needs to be some common ground in the next few weeks now to go and get this done. But they do have to make some additions. They've got to do this. And now's the time for me. You know, it's go and do it now while there's still a little bit, you know, yeah, all right, some guys might want to wait it out until they can do a test. There's not a load of money still available now. Teams have done drafts, they've done free agency. Some of these guys might just be better off taking a paycheck, trying to get a medical done with the Seahawks, getting a contract for next year, having some security. Go and get it sorted. Go and get some of these players signed.
All right, some of the UDFA names rolling in. You got quarterback Anthony Gordon, the Washington State quarterback. I mentioned Anthony Jones, the running back from FIU. You got Dibione Renfro, defensive back for Texas A&M. Also, Eli Menser out of Albany, a defensive end slash linebacker. You got Gavin Heslip, a Stony Brook cornerback, one of those Seahawks type corners that made it to free agency through the draft. And Josh Avery, a defensive tackle out of Southeast Missouri.
Yeah, I don't know a great deal about a lot of these players. I mean, we're in this period now whereby they're picking up guys who were not on the radar of anybody, really. You know, they will fit physical ideals. I will look forward to trying to find out a little bit more about them moving forward. But that's what this is about. You know, in this time, it is about going out and getting certain guys who can, you know, fit those ideals positionally and physically. You know, he recovered from being shot in the face last year and is a relative of the Vikings running back Dalvin Cook. It's funny, actually, because my wife turned around to me. She didn't watch any of the draft apart from this particular 5 minutes. But she said, a lot of these guys have had interesting lives. And it is quite interesting how many of these NFL players have just had the most incredible upbringings, haven't they? Or, you know, battled adversity, or have got stories about them that are just very interesting. And, you know, Anthony Jones has been shot in the face. I have to say, you know, in English football, in English soccer over here, most of the players don't have these interesting life stories.
That was something that it definitely jumped out, I feel like, in the broadcast. And I don't know if that was something that they intended to feature so heavily, but it did seem like we got a much more in-depth in a lot of these players' backstories in this draft.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm looking at the list now. Chris Miller, I know about. He's an absolute hammer. He is a violent hitter, you know, a bit of a headhunter at Baylor. I can see why they liked him and they've signed him. He was on my board earlier today. So I definitely with him, I can see why they've gone for that. Anthony Gordon, obviously, at Washington State, was really, really good at the Senior Bowl. I'm a little bit surprised that he's an undrafted free agent.
Why did he make it through the draft? Because he was a guy who, I mean, looking at PFF, they had him seventh among their quarterbacks. They had him potentially going, you know, third, fourth round type player. A little bit surprising he made it all the way through the draft.
Yeah, I'm surprised as well. I don't really understand why that is.
Especially after the success of Gardner Minshew, right? The guy that he's taken over for.
Yeah, but, you know, good for the Seahawks, because like I say, mentioned that he played well at the Senior Bowl. He is very dedicated to his craft. He's got a strong arm. He threw well at the combine as well. And, you know, for me, he has a legitimate chance to come in and try and compete for the backup role.
I guess looking at some of his stats, he was listed as having the second most turnover-worthy plays, which maybe doesn't fit into the Pete Carroll system very well.
Second most turnover-worthy plays. Yeah, that's probably why he got a that's probably why he's ended up undrafted then.
Well, Rob, really want to thank you for all the 3 days of draft coverage, all the coverage leading up to the NFL draft, and I'm sure, you know, in this offseason, we're going to be talking more about these young players and really how they're going to fit into the Seahawks team moving forward.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's just to finish off, I think it's been great, you know, that the NFL has actually the NFL received a lot of criticism, you know, on social media from a lot of people. And, you know, some of the local media people and some of the national media people were very critical, that accused the NFL of being tone deaf for going through with free agency and then sticking to their guns at the draft. It was controversial. I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, they've made it safe. They could do free agency remotely from home. They could do the draft in the way that they have. It's given us all something to talk about for weeks. It has given us a much needed distraction from the reality of life at the moment with coronavirus going on. I thought that the broadcast itself was fantastic. I really hope that they stick to elements of that, of the way that they did that. I thought even I find day three quite a frustrating watch sometimes. It sailed by today.
Yeah, I think Mayock would have approved of day three, how they did it this time versus how they did it in the past.
they cut away so much of the fat. You know, I know that some people like it when they, you know, they get the guests out to read the names out on the second and third round and stuff like that. But all that ends up happening is they get an old player out, and some of them just read the name, and some of them come out, they want to make it about them. They'll do a big speech, or they'll do some kind of elaborate pre-planned thing. Whereas this, it was just Roger Goodell getting out of his chair, reading the name out, and then sitting back down. Right. And then and the day three, they just announced the picks. I think it was a great watch. I think they did terrific. I thought Trey Wingo was amazing. I love Mel Kiper's energy. The fact that he can do that for hours and hours and hours and hours and talk about seventh round picks the way that he talked about the first round picks, I think is amazing. I think they're all really good broadcast. It was a great broadcast. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed this draft season. You know, I think it's been a good one, and it's given us all something to think about, coronavirus.
You know, one thing that I could see them taking out of this draft and using it in the future, because Roger Goodell was asked about that, because there has been such good feedback from fans around this draft. And it's been cool to kind of get a window into the lives of some of these coaches and general managers and seeing them at home and interacting with their kids as they're making the picks. You know, if they did day one and two from the facility and then did day three from home, I don't think that they would lose all that much of what's going on among the general managers and the teams and being able to make deals happen. I think this shows that it is possible to do this from home. So if day three of the NFL draft is work from home day for these coaches and general managers, I could see that working out very well. And maybe it does make day three of the draft a little bit more palatable than it was in the past.
Yeah, I look, I really hope that, I think Roger Goodell said it, that he said there are things that they're going to keep from this that they you know, otherwise would never have done if it wasn't for the fact they were forced to do it this year. I hope that doesn't just mean putting cameras up in players' homes who are not, you know, amongst the top 20 or 30 players who get invited to whichever city is hosting it. So it's Cleveland next year. I hope that means that, it, you know, they're actually going to think about doing it this way again, because it's just been so entertaining. You know, I've not been irritated by any of the coverage this year. It's been good. I think they've cut away so much of the fat of the broadcast coverage that we usually have. I think it's been a great broadcast. And, you know, it is a little bit sad always when a draft finishes, because you talk about these guys for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you dream about certain players being on your team, and you know, it's great to think about what is a successful draft constitute, and you have your own ideas on that, and then it all finishes and some of the players you really like end up on other teams, and you know, you've not really got anything else to look forward to immediately afterwards. You know, we're a long, long, long way away from NFL football being back. We don't know when it's going to be back because of coronavirus. So I imagine a lot of people might actually get up and feel probably quite miserable tomorrow, because the one sport that was kind of still ticking along is more or less done now. But, you know, we've got to find ways, you know, to entertain ourselves, do stuff like that. There are still going to be plenty of things to talk about. As mentioned, there's still a lot of things for the Seahawks to do. So I think it's still going to be a busy time in that regard.
We still will be a little bit busy, but now, at the end of day three, we can at least take a moment to celebrate that, at least celebrate the fact that we covered a lot of ground over the past few months. The Seahawks always come up with some surprises along the way, and it'll give us more to study up here in the coming weeks. So be sure and follow Rob on Twitter, @RobStaton. Check out SeahawksDraftBlog.com. Also, drop on over to TinyPiecesOfSeahawksStuff.com. Only 33 people are in the running for the Russell Wilson card with a tiny piece of Seahawks jersey in it. So, some good odds there for now. We'll pick a random winner at the end of the month. Just go on over to TinyPiecesOfSeahawksStuff.com and type in Go Hawks in the comments, and then tune in to the first episode of May to listen in for the winner. You can also support the show at GetInTheFlock.com. A lot of new members of the flock, and we'll be giving shout-outs coming up here when I talk with Adam on the next episode. Had a great time talking draft with Rob over these last 3 days. Can't wait to hear what Adam has to say after he has a chance to break some tape on some of the newest Seahawks players. So be sure and tune in for that next episode coming up. And with that, I think there's only one thing left to say. Go Hawks!